We're coming to the end of this first season of You Are Doing It Wrong, and I'm going to try, if I can, to kind of pull some of the loose ends together. Specifically today, I just want to round up what we did in overall game design, level design, and talk a little bit about exploration and the life cycle of a game, really, I suppose, which includes player progression, achievements, collectibles, those types of things. Anyway, fasten your seatbelts, because this is going to be a bumpy ride. In previous episodes regarding design generally, we've covered the main game modes and styles that you might find within a common or garden game. It could be an MMO, or you could be designing a hack and slash or some kind of action adventure game, or even an RPG. Everything operates fairly differently, but design tends to be the same. And that's the important thing about design, is that regardless of what it is that you're designing, whether you want to paint a room in your house, or you want to buy some new furniture and you don't quite know where everything's going to fit, you can use design for virtually anything. Maybe think of your living room as like a game of Tetris. Over the Christmas period, I bought a friend a box of Lego, and I hugely recommend that if you're a game designer in the making or a level designer and you really want to get your head around how stuff works, buy yourself some basic Lego and start building. That's the only way you're going to know if your game is going to be as successful as, say, Uncharted, Tomb Raider, or Indiana Jones, or Shenmue, or After Party. Insert your game here. It's a tip that we use to try and do a number of things. So by using Lego or by visualizing a level design, we can start to think about what we want our proving ground to look like, how we want our player to play, and what we want our player to experience, which is where exploration mode comes in. I'm a huge fan of exploration games. No, I'm not talking about walking sims. I'm not talking about action adventures. I'm talking about everything to do with exploration. You know, Mario and Sonic are all about exploring. They're all about exploring and experiencing. And if you put yourself in the position of a player, you should really want that too. Some designers think that exploration sucks, or that exploration isn't real, or exploration is the worst thing to happen to design, and that it's the worst thing to design within a game. I call bullshit. Exploration is actually a lot of fun. A lot of fun to design and a lot of fun to play. Exploration is the lifeblood of your entire game. What the player explores impacts massively on what they experience. So how you design trees, even a blade of grass in Skyrim, if you want to get really detailed, you've got to think about what the impact is going to be on the player. In some games that I've designed in the past, what I've tried to do is build spoken wheel design of play, which is combat or conflict or some kind of action, against exploration, which is more passive. It can be crafting, it can be finding, it can be uncovering, it can be discovering. But these things need to be planned. We don't just attack a level by saying, we are going to include 3 types of exploration in here, 4 types of conflict, and 5 kinds of combat, or whatever, or 40 cutscenes, or whatever. We don't attack level design like that. We approach level design and game design generally with an idea of what we think the player might experience. So if, in the case of playing Dungeons and Dragons, for example, you want to provide the player with various inns dotted around the map or the world that the player is playing in, then you have to provide a route to these inns. You have to provide a place where, regardless of the character that you've rolled, you can actually be in a place where everybody's the same. Call it a neutral zone if you want. Call it a ready room. You know, the type of thing that you might find in League of Legends. Call it a place where a clan gathers and an opposing clan gathers and no fighting happens. So just have a place, an inn, an area in mind where you can deliver quests, where people can feel neutral or characters can feel neutral, and where also you can layer, level or tier experiences depending on who is in the room. So that takes us back to what I talked about earlier about in an earlier episode about sharding. Actually, sharding is where you have sections of a server where an amount of people can play all at the same time, regardless of their level. We do try to put tolerances in on levels and abilities, but often we like to have a nice microcosm or cross-section of the census of game players. So here we are in our inn, and we're thinking about layering or tiering experiences on top of that. So where does the player go? Well, they can go to the barkeep and they can get a quest. And that quest will take them out to wherever it is that they want to go or choose to go. The quest could be anything from facing combat in the field as part of exploration. So it can be player versus environment, player versus player, where the player has to go and fight a warring faction or a clan to invoke or evoke movement within the game. And also the layering can be game modes. So you can actually have combat modes that are thrown in the field. Another super alternative is just crafting. You can send the player out on a quest to just go and craft a bunch of stuff. And that will give the player not only a given or set amount of time, but it also points them in the direction of player progression. It also makes them go to a place where maybe they wouldn't ordinarily go. They might try, in the case of Skyrim, to work their way through the Mage's Guild, you know? So they might have to learn alchemy, conjuring, all this kind of stuff. This is crafting, okay? But also, it can later be used. If you're a metal worker or an armorer, you can armor fantastic equipment that you can then later sell and make gold coins for. Or you can wear the equipment yourself and kick some actual ass, if that's your will. You should also remember that in some games, there are naturally opportunities where the game developer, the studio, might decide that they want to monetize certain areas. So it becomes quite elite. There are certain special places that only you can go to. You know, it's not like DC Universe Online, where you just go to the precinct and hang out with 40 different Batmans. You might be hanging out the top Batman of a certain clan, for example, and that costs money. And so you have to think, as a game designer, what exciting shit am I gonna give the player to really make them want to stay in here? Otherwise, they're gonna feel like they've been sold a complete and utter pup, right? So we don't want that to happen. So you need to make monetized zones the most exciting places on earth. That's why monetizing games is both the easiest thing in the world to do or the most difficult. There is no kind of in between. There's no sort of, well, you know, I don't really know how I feel about this. I guess it's okay. There is no I guess it's okay when you monetize stuff. Either everybody approaches a game with the same wants, needs and experiences, a little bit like the hierarchy of needs or the cycle of behaviours, or alternatively, the player pays to win, pays to progress, pays to experience. And that's something totally different. In my opinion and my experience, time management games do this really effectively and very, very well. They put players in a situation where the player is really kind of, I have to pay for this, or I'm not going to be able to do X, or I'm not going to be able to help my clan out, or I'm not going to be able to battle that dude, or I'm not going to be able to craft that special item. But please don't think for one moment that just by monetizing an area or an experience that somehow you don't have to do anything else, because that's BS. But tiered gameplay is about progression. It's about rewarding the player at the end of every tier, saying, yeah, you did really well, we're going to give you this, this and this. Or now we're going to open up the fog of war. Of course, you all know what the fog of war is. It's that kind of weird area that's not been uncovered, that's either in the dark or covered by a fog or a mysterious mist. It's just a fog of war, okay? It just means that you haven't progressed far enough to be able to go there yet. It's also a really great device that you can use in game design to gate and hold your players back without limiting or putting a barrier to entry into the game. So remember how we talked right at the beginning about ludology and tic-tac-toe? This is where player progression comes into real force. Between RPGs and action adventure games, you will see why player progression is so important. The first few levels of a game versus the XP or experience points, whatever you're going to pay the player with for achieving, has to be an upward learning curve. If it's a complete diagonal line on the graph from 0 or 1 to whatever your end level is, then the point is that you need to give the player a steep learning curve in order for them to have that level of mastery. You find these types of player progression models in mid-core games, and you know, we don't really use that term so much anymore because we're so engrossed at the moment in a world of casual and hyper-casual gaming that we've sort of lost our way a little bit outside of mobile. A steep learning curve is an opportunity for you to be able to balance how the player plays. And player progression is so important because you don't want the player to blow their entire wad in the first few days of gameplay or the first few hours of gameplay, because as we saw in previous episodes of You Are Doing It Wrong, that it's really important that we measure this and meter this delivery so that we can later record how the player plays, what the experience is, and more importantly for studios, how much money they're making out of it. You know, they're bringing out Final Fantasy VII for the PS4 and possibly for this new PlayStation device. And it's interesting because everybody who is approaching Final Fantasy VII, the remake, knows exactly how this game ends. What they don't know at the moment, unless they've played a few of the levels, I have, is that there is different ways of being able to play these levels that we never had when we were playing in the original PlayStation. So super cool for a game designer to look at an existing, tried, tested, and well-loved game level and really rigorously deconstruct and reconstruct how this game is played. It's a little bit like remastering a Pink Floyd album. How you twiddle those knobs really makes a total difference to Dark Side of the Moon, potentially. And the same thing is true for some of the incredible remakes that are coming out over the next few years. I know that they're going to do Final Fantasy VIII, for sure, and definitely Final Fantasy X has been released on the PlayStation 4, for sure, in the PlayStation Store, but it's the old version, so that says to me that they're probably going to redux, and that's the key word, redux. They're going to rethink how they made this game without changing the design massively, without changing the storyline, but just giving the player a little bit more of an opportunity to progress within the game. That means that the player will stay longer and that the player gets value for money, and therefore you as a studio make a better profit. As we wrap up this part of design, exploration, player progression, I just wanted to talk about system design, because I'm a big lover of system design. I've done a lot of system design. I've got one of those sort of minds where I like writing stories, imagining things, using those types of lateral skills and abilities. So system design is both really dry and really exciting. If you like cataloguing things, like if you know your Pokemons and how to cluster them and how to use them and when, if you've got an encyclopedic mind, you should really go to the dark side of game design, which is called system design. and it's where every single leaf is catalogued, categorised. So for example, I talk about this quite a lot because I think they do it really well, but the Elder Scrolls, any of the Elder Scrolls games, you will find things that have names. Gold Mountain Flower, Nern Root, not just a standard pearl, not just a standard crab, but a mud crab. Different types of armors, different kinds of metals, different types of wood, different things to put through alchemy, different things to conjure with, different potions to make. There are millions of different things in Elder Scrolls. And again, just going back to the reasons why we want to give the players a great experience, it's really simple. And the Elder Scrolls kind of hits the nail on the head. We don't want the player to leave. We don't want them to go off and make a cup of tea. We don't want them to go to the loo. We certainly don't want them to watch Love Island. For God's sakes, keep the player in the game until the end. How do games end? When they have to come to an end, it's sad. It's always been real, right? We say goodbye. And we do it in a variety of different ways. Here's just a few. Trial by combat is a classic. A story ending, another classic. But some developers, and I've just mentioned a huge developer, Bethesda, they do additional stages, releases, patches, DLCs. League of Legends do seasons, Fortnite does seasons. There's so much to love about video games because we don't really have to ever end a game if we don't want to. But some games have to come to a natural end. So how does Donkey Kong end? Well, it ends with a kill screen and that's it. So the kill screen happens, it's over. If you've ever watched King of Kong, you have to be a really special kind of game player to understand and move over the pain of a kill screen, because you're really just going after points. You're not going after story. You're certainly not trying to be the best at catching Princess Peach or whatever her name was in Donkey Kong. Actually, what was her name? Linda or something. Really what the player needs to do is just get the most points, because it's an arcade game and you're playing against your peers. You're not really playing against the game per se. What happens at the end of Pokemon? At the end of Pokemon, you become an elite trainer. And so it means that you can prestige your way through the game as an absolute god. It is a way of never having to leave the game, but it's not the best way of never having to leave the game. What happens at the end of Metal Gear Solid? Metal Gear Solid has a very definite story ending. The story of Metal Gear Solid ends, and the player makes their peace with that. So the player has done everything that they can do to that point. I think the end of Final Fantasy VII has a slight little twist in the penultimate phase of the game. And that's what makes the player sort of go, oh my god, because defeating Sephiroth is not nearly as rewarding as what happens before you defeat Sephiroth. Spoilers! I'm not gonna give you any spoilers. And what happens at the end of GTA 4, GTA 5, what happens at the end of Red Dead Redemption? Well, again, we've got all kinds of story endings here. And something that someone pointed out to me recently in a lecture about Red Dead Redemption. Red Dead Redemption is like the ultimate walking sim. So really, the denouement, which we'll talk about in another season of the game, is not necessarily that important compared to all of the other shit that you can do within the game. So just bear that in mind. Give your player a final activity, but choose how you want that activity to present itself. There are no hard and fast rules, but don't spring something weird like a kill screen at the end of a game like Metal Gear Solid, because the player's gonna hate you. And you know, Kojima was aware of that. And so Kojima made sure that story was at the heart of everything that happened in Metal Gear Solid, even if gameplay was the strongest thing that happened. You can always contact me, argue with me, and give me any game theories that you have about how games should end. So as we approach the end of this season, some essential reading for you might be really helpful. And my big go-to thing is always Norman's The Design of Everyday Things. The Design of Everyday Things is incredible. incredible. It came out in 1990 and it is an essential read for anybody who wants to be a designer. Please also look at tutsplus.com, which is gamedevelopment.tutsplus.com, and then have a look at Sonny Bone's articles about minimalism in game design. Keeping it simple is the greatest thing that we can possibly do. Al Lowe's game designs are always a great laugh. Anything Leisure Suit Larry related is well worth diving into and really getting under the skin of what makes a game so successful from the perspective of experience and story without having to go down the whole Dungeons and Dragons route. Though you can do if you want. Al Lowe provides some really great examples of good game design and great game design documents. And then finally, your sort of go-to for a lot of places would be Gama Sutra. Whether you're thinking about art, whether you're thinking about programming, or you're a budding designer, have a look at creating a great design document. It's a feature that was in Gama Sutra a couple of years ago by Tveezy Freeman. And because I'm a complete ludological nerd, the Introduction to the Theory of Game Elements by Aki Järvinen is an essential slideshow for anybody who wants to understand ludology in its most basic form, so that you can really drill down further into what makes a game absolutely incredible. So it's the end of this first season. I just want to thank everybody who's contacted me, asked questions. I want to thank everyone who's downloaded it. God, it means a lot. And I'm really looking forward to starting season two, which shouldn't be that far behind. I think I'm going to put a bonus season in to prepare you guys for actually making a game. Until then, keep making and keep playing. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you for listening. You can tweet Kelly at Electric Geisha. You can listen to You Are Doing It Wrong where all good pods are casted. You can email the podcast doingitwrongpod@gmail.com.